Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There are no stories without meaning. So says the historian Nikitas in Umberto Eco's latest novel, Baudolino. I am one of those men, he goes on, who can find the meaning even where others fail to see it. Afterward, the story becomes the book of the living, like a blaring trumpet that raises from the tomb those who have been dust for centuries. And so it's back to the 12th century we go, into the intrigue and the sacking and attacking of German soldiers and Italian cities, back to the time of the Third Crusade. But a trip back with Umberto Eco somehow doesn't read much like history. No, Eco's new book is named for the puckish and peripatetic character Baudolino. It is profane and ribald, laced with lies, court intrigue, adventure, and humor. And it also draws the story out of a multitude of languages. Sound familiar? Yes, it is the perfect playground for Umberto Eco, whose imagination races from reused parchment of 1,000 years ago into the pop culture kaleidoscope of an internet search engine. Connection listeners, we look at the world in such little bites. History in one book, cultures in another language, that's the department down the hall. But what happens when those disciplines are all combined? How is our understanding of the world changed? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And it's my great pleasure to welcome to the studio Umberto Eco.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for being here. That's the beginning of the book, when Nicetas is explaining that he can put meaning in where other people cannot find it.
Yes.
But at the end of the book, Nicetas is saying that sooner or later, he's just decided he's never ever going to tell this story. Sooner or later, he says, a greater liar than Baudolino will tell this story.
That's the signature of the author.
That's you.
Now, also, because, you know, the last chapter is the only one it's me who is speaking, because all the rest of the novel is a dialogue between Baudolino and Nicetas, and Nicetas cannot realize whether Baudolino says the truth or not. And so there is this continuous ambiguity if Baudolino invents once again something like the Kingdom of Prester Jones. But the last chapter, it's me that I am speaking, and me, I am the author, so I am God. I tell the truth, and I tell that Baudolino is going back. So if he's going back, it means that he was there. This is the only truth of my novel.
The rest is all lies, and all part of history. Some people listening to us will not have read Baudolino. It's just out in the United States in its English translation. Tell us a little bit about this character, Baudolino, how you created him, what you wanted to make with him.
At the beginning, I was thinking of a contemporary novel taking place in a newspaper, people opening a new newspaper. The title should have been Number Zero, and they were inventing false scoops. At a certain point, I realized that the plot was very similar to the one of my Foucault's Pendulum, so I said, okay. And then I asked myself, which was the greatest false scoop in history? And I said, the letter of Prester Jones. We can speak of that later, but it was really written as a forgery in the 12th century. I went back to the letter. I discovered that it was written probably at the same moment in which my native city was founded, set up, in order to face Frederick Barbarossa. So I had the idea of putting together the letter and my roots, to rediscover my roots. And I started writing in this strange invented dialect that occupies the first 10 pages of the book and that terrifies so much the readers that opens the book and say, also, I don't understand. Okay? And by writing in this invented language, I built up Baudolino. Baudolino was born as a way of speaking. His psychology, all the rest, came later. And so he was born from my memories of my childhood, of my native area, the way of thinking of these people. Baudolino is a peasant of the northwestern Italy, smart, is a rascal, it seems he's a liar, because he lies continuously. But if you remark, everything he says becomes real history. So he doesn't lie about the present and past, like liars do, usually. He lies about the future. So he's a visionary.
And he makes friends with the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa. This is his ticket to power. This is the way that he insinuates himself into the historical events that follow the emperor. And I went back into a rather dry history book just to check, because it's not a part of the world history that I know very well. And there it all is, up to and including the emperor falling into the river and drowning.
Yes, I used the chronicles of that time, because what I do usually in my novels is to discover that French says, la réalité dépasse la fiction. The real events are always more fictional and exciting than the invented stories. In all my books, I used things that really happened and that look incredible because they really happened. So if you browse in the chronicles of that time, the siege, tortures, battles, It's extremely novelistic, it's extremely Romanesque. Then I had a personal problem with Frederick Barbarossa, because for an Italian boy in the primary school, you start studying that Barbarossa was the great enemy.
He's the one who sacked Milan.
The villain, the bad guy. And by reading the biography of Barbarossa, you discover that it was a different character, a visionary, he too. He, in his own way, he loved Italy. He spent most of his life in Italy, risking to lose his empire in Germany because he wanted to be loved. And by Italians, and in order to be loved, he massacred them. And so in my book, Barbarossa becomes not a bad guy, but a good guy. And it was a sort of revenge against the myths I was nurtured with.
When we try to animate the history of that time in our mind, though, we do it in such a formal way because, I don't know, I mean, it must be because the history books, which was all we ever read, teach us of the kings and the formal, careful language of the time. Your characters, your royalty, your men of learning are likely to swat each other on the back of the head and say, "Don't be such a dickhead. This is what we should be doing here." You use this language. You actually move it into the 12th century. Now, you're doing that for a reason.
No, well, if you want to classify this book, you could define it as a picaresque novel. So my problem was to make these popular characters to speak as they would speak today, and I used all the dialect of my region as much I could. I made also philological research, for instance, profanities, four letters words. I wanted to be sure that certain bad words that are still used today by dialect were originally from the Middle Ages. The word balls for testicles. I discovered that in the Longobard Hauptdeutsch, it existed, the ethim, ball. So, okay, I could use it because it existed before. So that was a terrible problem for the translators, because is not that you cannot translate a profanity, okay, in every language, but the habits are different. An Italian or a Spaniard can say profanities that a German couldn't. It wouldn't be accepted.
As
blasphemies.
Right.
Blasphemies. A peasant in Spain, in Italy, or in France can say things that, if translated into German, sound horrible, really infernal. So
much of the French foul language is based in the church, which doesn't play well in English, or doesn't translate into English.
And so it was a terrible problem for the translators to render. Today I have a lecture here. I want to show some of the different translation of the same four-letter word in five different languages. It changes. It changes not the word. I would say that the psychological level of the utterer. It's an interesting research.
So when you sit down and negotiate these different translations with the different translator. Now, you speak French, Spanish, German, Italian, and English. Does that mean that you can work eyeball to eyeball with the translators who are translating into German and into English and into French?
Well, I usually work with my translators, and I can work pretty well with some of them who translate in a language I don't know. If the translator is intelligent, he is able to tell you, I have this problem in my language. Could I solve it? So I worked pretty well with my Russian translator, a marvelous lady that is able to explain me what happens in Russian with that sentence, with the Hungarian, with the Japanese one. Obviously, I can work better with Spanish, English, but I thank you because you have pronounced a word, negotiation. I am just finishing a book on translation, in which I reflect about my personal experience, not only mine, but mainly with my. And this book is under the standard of negotiation. A translation is a continuous process of negotiation. Okay, I lose this, but I can recuperate that. So let me make a balance of gain and losses. And so, what was the effect to be produced on the reader? We can produce this effect with a different sentence. The problem is not to translate literally, but to produce the same effect. So negotiation is an important notion, not only in international politics.
Well, you spoke about it once, like trying to buy a carpet in a bazaar. Here's $100. No, I'll take 50. No, it'll be 75. Connection listeners, my guest is Umberto Eco. He is here to talk about his new book, Baudolino. We're interested in having you join our conversation on any one of the number of levels that we read, that we hear, that we watch the work and the thought and the ideas of Mr. Eco. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join our conversation. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest in studio, Umberto Eco. He's here to talk about his latest book, Baudolino. We're talking about translation, and I know that you spend time playing with the internet, seeing what it offers us or what different range it gives us. So I stumbled across these Italian sites, German sites, and discovered that on this French site, your book, The Name of the Rose, is in fact Name of the Pink. Nom de la Rose, right? And if you go to the Italian site and look up Foucault's pendulum, it becomes Hangs It Off Foucault. I love the way the machinery takes the words, because it is in a way so different from the way that you'll be working with the translator and trying to find the
meaning. No, but I mentioned you the my book on translation. I started taking the beginning of the Bible in the King James Version and giving it to an automatical translation service by Alta Vista, having it translated into Spanish, then from Spanish to English, then from English again to German, then from German to English. The results are marvelous. The spirit of God that becomes immediately the alcohol of God, and is a great amusement. Automatical mechanical translation is very difficult because you cannot negotiate. We mentioned the notion of negotiation.
The importance of figuring out what is the meaning, whether or not it's the meaning of the writer that's important or the meaning of the understanding of the person who's going to be reading it.
I gave once the works of Shakespeare in the third translation. They were the plans of Shakespeare because for the computer work means plans, opus, and so on. In order to understand that the works are literary works, you must have notions about Shakespeare. And to know that he was not an industrial tycoon, but a writer. But the computer has no notions about Shakespeare. It has only a dictionary, not an encyclopedia.
Let's go back to your book, because one of the things I wanted to get you talking to me about is that this is a fictional book. And yet, there's more to it than fiction. You're telling us something about the way that history is created, that history is... the real history, our history, is a fabrication of many different threads that could be as many lies as truths, and we can't know that. That's a message that I got the second time through the book.
Yes, the message is a double one. You know that Niketas was a real Byzantine historian, and the quotation you read at the beginning were real words.
That's his
written by more or less fashioned by me, but
from Greek to Italian to English, but we're close.
But more or less, it was he had reflections about history. He all the description of the destruction of Constantinople. Mm. I used the chronicle of Niketas. Niketas is a good historian, so he doesn't trust Baudolino because he knows that documents must be checked, but is fascinated by the ambiguity of these days. So this is the problem of historian. What kind of document should I trust? But there is another problem that fascinates me, that a lot of times false or wrong ideas and documents produced real history. In every sense, even the most horrible aspects of our history, take the protocols of the elders of science that produced the Holocaust. They are a forgery. We know step by step as they were forged, but they produced history. Huh? A history we don't like, but okay, it was a real one. Christopher Columbus sailed toward America using false maps, and probably knew that they were incorrect. But since he wanted to go, he tried to believe that they were correct.
It's in everything, isn't it? I mean, the Spanish search for
El Dorado yes.
was bunkum, and the search for the Northwest Passage, which was going to take people to India. I mean,
but you know, the discovery of Australia was due to the fact that for centuries, if you look at the old maps, people believed that there was the Terra Incognita, a sort of enormous, huge Antarctic continent covering the southern part of the Earth. And people sailed for years to look for the Terra Incognita. Even Cook, they didn't find it, but they found Australia. The Prester Jones letter in the Renaissance, the letter was rewritten, and while in the period of my novel the kingdom was believed to be in the Far East, later it was moved to Africa. All the Portuguese exploration of Africa was made under the standard of Prester John. And
this
they...
is a letter that is purported to have been written by Prester John, a great Christian
yes.
saint who is somewhere in the East. And
yes.
he writes it to the Pope, does he not?
He writes the letter initially to the Basileus, to the emperor of Constantinople, and says, I am better than you, my kingdom is enormous, is full of marvels, jewels, gold, strange monsters, and so on and so on and so on and so forth. And the probably the idea of the forger, we don't know, maybe it was only a play, but it was used in order, I would say, in a sort of colonial perspective. If there is a Christian kingdom beyond the Saracen, the Muslim world, so we have the right to go there, because to put together those two branches, sides of the Christian world. When the kingdom was moved to Africa, the Portuguese looked for the Prester John, and then they discovered it, because they found the Christian kingdom. It was Abyssinia, Ethiopia. They said, and for years they called Prester John the Negus of Ethiopia. But since Ethiopia was not so exciting like the Prester John's kingdom, it was a poor country, at that moment, when it was found, the legend fell apiece.
There is an inviolability to the religious symbols and relics that mark the history that you write about. The head of John the Baptist is something that is dug deep into Christian understanding and mythology. I went to some mosque in Syria at some point, and someone said, it's in there, by the way, if you're wondering where the head of John the Baptist is. In your book, there are six, if I'm not mistaken, heads of John the Baptist.
They were more in reality. But you tell the story of relics is another one. It was clear that the same relic existed in two places, and a lot of people knew it, but they didn't pay attention. What was at that moment the political importance of the relics? If a city had an important relic, it became the target of pilgrimage. It was an economic problem. I tell the story of the kings. The bodies of the kings were allegedly found in Milano, and Reinald von Dassel, who was the chancellor of the emperor, brought them to Cologne. And for that city, it was like to have a new skyscraper, to have the seventh marvel of the world. So relics were a way to forge something in order to produce something else.
It could be the toe of the saint. It could be the tooth of the Buddha. These are things that you know, people go to various cities to yes. worship in the temples. Or
today we would call it a touristic affair. If you have Disneyland in Los Angeles, there will be a lot of people going there. So you make a new Disneyland in Orlando, and you don't pay attention to the fact that there are two. No, okay, you make a third one near Paris for touristic purposes. At that time...
But the difference is nobody's pretending that Euro Disney is a unique and special location. Everybody acknowledges that it's a copy in the myth of the relic.
Because there is more information today. And we can control the problem.
You say if the information was not there, it would be in the interest of the Disney people outside Paris to say, come to this unique place.
Unique place.
Let's go to our first of our callers. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Lexington, North Carolina, and Bruce joins us. Hello, Bruce.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Professor Echo.
Hi.
At the end of the rose, in the name of the rose, there is a Latin phrase.
Yes.
I asked a priest to translate it. He got very disturbed and refused. Could you please put it into English?
You know, you are the first to put this question. I am pleased. Now, is a verse appearing in a poem of that period. The poem was, it was a topos, a normal literary argument that the things of this world vanishes. You know, the great empires, the great cities that existed before, then disappeared, and so on and so forth. So the translation of the last verse, and you have to take into account that it comes after the author has said the big cities like Babylon have disappeared, the great kings are today dust, and so on. Stat Rosa Pristina nomine, the rose of yesterday remains only through its name. The object is no more existing, you have only the names. So we can have only naked names.
Well, thank you, because now I understand, given the text context of the book, why it bugged the priest so much.
And then, you know, there is another version of the same poem that instead of Rosa says Rome, Roma.
Ah.
Stat Roma, Roma, Pristina, nomine, nomina. So it is like instead of saying Babylon or the old city, even the Rome of the past has been destroyed and we have only the name. Then there are metrical reasons I cannot explain now, for which probably the right version was Rosa and not Roma. But the sense would be the same, you know?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Bruce. Do these, I'm thinking of Bruce's conversation with his priest, and you've had your own run-ins with religious leaders who have criticized Name of the Rose. They may not like the idea that you have the Genoese travelers deciding to stop and make a pile of money by creating relics. They decide that they can't reproduce the baskets that held the loaves and the fishes, but they do decide that they can create Noah's axe.
Yeah.
I mean, you're very fast with the religious features in the book with of that time.
Among my 30 honorary degrees, there are 4 coming from 4 Catholic universities. So you see that people in universities know history.
This is not an uncomfortable place for you to be criticized by churchmen on one hand. That doesn't bother you?
No, it's, you know, when you write a book, you have to expect everything. Okay.
When you stitch it together, though, you do borrow as much from the popular language and our understanding of the way people relate to each other in today's world. That's what you're putting back in historical terms. Do we need to see history more as a reflection of who we are rather than a distant reflection of what happened then?
Listen. I am not an historian, but anyway, I think that to write history, even both in an academic book, the real history of England, or an historical novel, is the same that looking at an event taking place in a square from a balcony. It depends on the balcony you are, the perspective you can have on the scene. You can see it from northwest or east or south. Every historian is writing leaning from a balcony. So history is always revisited from the point of view of our own obsessions, interests. Before starting this interview, you kindly said that you have read twice my novel, and the second time you had the impression to read a second novel.
Then it was completely different. It wasn't the first one that I read.
Okay. In 2-3 days or 2 weeks, you had changed. Even your cells have changed. Your memory has changed. Your preoccupation, I don't know. You have changed certain aspects of your mind, and so you have looked at the book from a different balcony. The ambition of an author is usually to write a book that can be read from different points of view. But to make history is the same problem. The same document can be read in the 19th century or in the 20th century by a German or by an Italian according to a different perspective. And so you drop certain elements and you focus other elements. There was an Italian philosopher, Benedetto Croce, that I don't like, but he said once, think that history is always contemporary history. When Gibbon writes about the fall of the Roman Empire, he writes it from the point of view of a man of his century. And if you read the contemporary chronicles at the times of the fall of the empire, they saw different things, maybe resorting to the same documents. Cela dit, in fact, obviously, when writing a novel, well, you are more free. The only problem is not to say what didn't happen. So to write an historical novel means you can insert characters that never existed, but that can become very representative of their time. The ambition is not to make a real character to do something that he or she couldn't have done. You can say that Frederick Barbarossa utters a certain sentence, but it must be coherent with the rest of his real life. You cannot say that Barbarossa really died in that river. You cannot make Barbarossa die in a different way. But you are free. You are free to wrap your historic elements with other elements in order, hopefully, to make your historical survey more real and more correct than an academic book, if possible.
I have to stop you there. We're taking a short break. My guest is Umberto Eco. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. There is an English translation of his latest fiction available in the United States. It's called Bartolino. And we're talking about the characters in that and the way that you create fictional history. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Umberto Eco. And we're talking in part about his new book, Bartolino, and in part about his view of the world. You have said in previous lectures that we find ourselves in history all the time. So when you go back to write a historical novel, do you think of characters and players who we're all familiar with in our world today and use them to illustrate history? Is there a Saddam Hussein in an Osama bin Laden in historical writing of Umberto Eco?
When you go to a psychoanalyst, you don't have any precise idea in your mind. And the psychoanalyst asks you to tell about your dreams. And you speak, and you speak, and you speak, and then the psychoanalyst says, you see that you remember a past event of your life that can explain your present situation. I think I've never been the psychoanalyst, so I saved a lot of money, and I am very well balanced and neurotic. But I think that writing a novel is the same. I get always irritated when a journalist asks me, what are the relationship between this book, this novel, and Berlusconi and present Italy? If I have to write something about Berlusconi, I write an article. I don't waste that time to write a novel. So for a novel, I start from an image or something I like, and I develop it. It can happen that when consulting an old documents, for instance, in Baudolino, there are real stories about the fights of the Italian cities against Barbarossa. By reading those documents, I was thinking to certain contemporary events of the Italian League about the independence of the northern Italy, but in a way that has nothing to do with my book. It's you, as a reader, that by exploring this past world, you can say, oh, now I understand why today is happening something like that. It's a side effect. In the Middle Ages, they wrote allegories just in order to demonstrate something. I think that if a modern author writes an allegory to demonstrate something, well, the book is dead from the beginning. So I don't have this kind of preoccupation. But then, as a reader of myself, I can discover a certain connections with our time.
You go back, you read what you wrote, and you discover things about yourself that you hadn't intended when you wrote the book?
Yes. I write a book just in order to have reading material. Better than the usual stuff.
We're going to go to a call here. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Anthony, who's joining us from Platteville, Wisconsin. Hi, Anthony.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks
Hi.
For calling.
Professor Eco, I have been... it would be wrong to say that I've studied your works deeply, but I've sort of orbited around a couple of them for a long time and always had a great deal of pleasure doing so. I was wondering if I could beg your indulgence. I haven't really bothered to corroborate this with other critics or even looked too deeply in other interviews to see if you've commented on this before, but I have a sense as I read... The Name of the Rose, and Foucault's Pendulum in different ways, that the narrative structure is sort of paralleling the sort of themes at the center of the novels. In other words, as I read Name of the Rose, I sort of get a sense that the narrative structure is proceeding in a kind of a maze-like or labyrinthine fashion, much like the library at the center of the novel, or in Foucault's Pendulum, that there is a sort of a circular motion of the structure kind of circling around the center of the book in a way, and not in a bad way, not actually reaching that center. I wonder if you would comment on that. I hope the question's not too banal.
Mm-hmm. You are a good reader. Thank you. I tell you, usually a book takes me 6 or 8 years, a novel. The Pendulum took me 8 years. And for the first 2 years, I don't write. I design, I draw, I make diagrams, which have nothing to do with the story. I don't know what will happen inside. But, for instance, I could show you my drawings for the Pendulum, where there is a sort of structure. I knew that the character should start inside the Conservatoire des Arts Métiers, then to remember something that happened before, then. And there is a sort of spiral-like structure that then I follow in writing the book. And before writing The Name of the Rose, I constructed so many labyrinths that you cannot imagine. So I think that afterwards, I consider the way I wrote a novel is a double way. Once a sort of seminal image that fascinates me, mm-hmm. The Pendulum, okay, or an island you cannot reach. And then another abstract image that is a sort of a temporal and spatial structure. Then I fill up the events. But this elementary structure is very important for me. Obviously, in the course of the work, I can decide to change the structure. But there must be always a structure.
Anthony, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I would venture a guess that The Balcony has something to do with Baudolino, in that the story is told in the tower, that so many of the events, the seminal events of the novel, the fake death of the emperor, these all happen in
in that
closed smoke. Stone spaces that look out over the action that's taking place below. But I think I have to read it again.
From the architectural point
the
of view.
Architecture of the novel is.
Well, I visit attentively all those constructions in Constantinople, in the tower, too. It was... okay.
It's all still there. Or what you can... enough to work with.
Yes. It's a Pera tower. I set it on the other side of the channel, but I always have in mind certain real buildings I have seen, and then I can move them in some way. But
right.
Yes, I need this contact with reality. I always say that if I had to write a book saying when the train stopped at the station of Limoges, he went out to buy the newspaper and then I must go to Limoges and to see how much time it takes to step down from the train to buy the newspaper and to come back. In the Pendulum, there are two publishing houses that are in two different buildings but linked together mm-hmm. by a door with three steps. Because I imagine that if they belonged to two different buildings, in order to equate them, to make them on the same level, you have to construct three steps. I designed those steps a lot of times to see how much it was possible. Then in the book, as far as I remember, they are not mentioned, but I needed to know where they are, to know what movement my characters had to do in order to pass from one office to another. Otherwise, I was told that the great director, Luchino Visconti, if two actors had to talk about jewels in a drawer, even though the drawer was never opened, he wanted inside real jewels. Otherwise, he said that the actors were not so natural. In their acting.
1-800-423-8255. Anthony, thanks for that call to Louisville, Kentucky now, and Catherine's joining us. Hi, Catherine.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me on the show. I have a question to Umberto Eco. First of all, I would like to congratulate him. I call him the Erasmus of today. And I've been reading several books, but I started with one years ago, where I did a thesis on, and it was called La structure absente.
Yes.
I read it in French. Now, this was for me a skeleton, really a skeleton to see life, and a beginning of semiology and a big interest in it. Now, after reading all the other books, even How to Travel with a Salmon, your discussion with the bishop about our beliefs today, of course, the Pendulum, the Island of the Day of Tomorrow, I would
stop,
like to have...
Stop. Read something else.
I do read something else. Just because I do read something else, I would like you to write a new structure absent, because there's so much evolution now today in meanings of what we live in this century right now in this latest year. Do you think you could do that for us?
Well, I did it. This book, La Structure Absente, was never published in English for a very stupid reason. I had the first translation, which was horrible, and tried to correct it, and I couldn't. And it became another book in English, which is A Theory of Semiotics. But then, in order, 20 years later, I have tried to review my theories from the point of view of new problems, and this book is Kant and the Platypus,
uh-huh.
in which, confronting myself with the myself of 30 years before and re-examining many semiotic problems from the point of view of cognitive sciences and so on. I don't know if it is exactly what you need, but in any case, it is the only thing I was able to do.
Catherine?
Is it related to the fiction you write? That was my question. Is it related to all the fiction you write lately?
It is related... In this sense, that these Kant and the Platypus is philosophical and semiotical books, but full of stories. In order to analyze certain problems and to demonstrate them, I invent stories. And that was probably due to my narrative experience. This wish to discuss also philosophical problems through stories, let's call them parables.
Catherine, thanks for your call. I want to just close, if I can, by asking you to try and explain the difference between an author who is so precise that he will spend months researching the stones in a tower in a city to tell us a fictional story, when you know that I'm going to read this book, or someone in Seoul, South Korea is going to read this book, will bring something entirely different to it. At some point, you are exercising control, and at another level, you are releasing control entirely.
I could say that I don't care. I could tell you the real truth. I put Byzantium or Constantinople in the book because I wanted to visit Constantinople. So I didn't visit Constantinople for the sake of the book. I wrote the book for the sake of Constantinople. I wrote the island of the day before because I wanted to see a Melanesian island. So I went there. So I didn't go there for the sake of the book. I wrote the book for the sake of this trip. Well, this is not exactly the truth, but there is a part of it that should be taken seriously.
We're sort of back where we began.
Your question was another. If I understood it correctly, it was, okay, you waste so much time to be precise in your documentation, and then the reader can enjoy such a freedom that he can read something else.
I wasn't talking about it as a waste of time, but yeah, okay.
No, wait. I could say you can read a lot of things in the book, but not everything, and you cannot read everything just because I was so precise. I mean, if I build up a labyrinth, you can lose your life turning around and choosing different paths. But if you cannot go out of the labyrinth by jumping over the walls, it is just because I have constructed those walls. So you can choose many paths, but I have, in a way, predetermined some of them.
Thank you so much for coming into the program today. Umberto Eco, professor of semiotics at the University of Bologna, author of the new novel, Bottolino. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR. Coming up next on...